In our first headline, not happy with your tax refund? Well, here's how to make your own. And in our second headline, why do more than a third of workers retire earlier than expected? Those two headlines, plus the big idea tying them all together, and much more on today's Money in the Morning. Welcome to Money in the Morning. I am Bobby Rebel from the Financial Grown Up Podcast, coming to you from my very grown up kitchen in New York City.
I'm Joe Saul Sehi in my mom's half finished basement in Detroit, Michigan.
And this is the podcast where we cover two recent stories ripped from the financial press. We don't just read them, though, like some other podcasts. We get into why they matter to you, to your wallet, and what you can do to use the information to invest, to save, to maybe pay down your debt in the most effective way. And we're going to wrap it all up at the end with a big idea that you can take with you to have a richer life. Money in the Morning is brought to you by Tiller. Manage your money 10 times faster in a spreadsheet with Tiller, the only service that connects your banks to Google Sheets and Excel with your daily spending, transactions, and balances. Go to stackingbenjamins.com/Tiller for more info. How you doing, Joe?
I am so happy to be here. We got a couple great headlines.
We do. I mean, the first one, what a teaser there. That is awesome. I want to make my own tax refund.
Who doesn't?
I actually have not gotten a refund in any recent year, and I don't think I'm getting one this year, but I'd love to make it happen.
Someday, Bobby. Someday.
Someday. Someday.
Well, let's get the party started, huh?
Here are today's Money in the Morning headlines.
All right, Joe, as promised, our first headline is going to be make your own tax refund. So this is a piece from Reuters. It's called Your Money, Unhappy with Your Tax Refund, Make Your Own. It is by my friend Beth Pinsker, who is a very talented writer over at my former employer, Reuters. She used to, in fact, edit my pieces, so we are eternally grateful for the hard work that she put into making me sound coherent. Here's the piece. One thing we have learned in the United States this tax season, refunds make Americans happy. Not getting one or getting a smaller one makes them mad. The number of refunds for 2018 returns is down 26.5%.
Wow.
And wait, this is a big one. The dollar amount of those that even get refunds is also down. It's down 16.7%. So that is, by the way, according to the latest numbers from the IRS, comparing the first 3 weeks of filing data against last year. And just a side note, that's pretty telling because the people that would file early on, Joe, are the people that think they're getting refunds. So I think the numbers could even get worse. Those are sort of the best of the worst.
Sure.
So for the moment, the piece goes on, people are mad. But, and this is where we like it, there is something you can do about it. If you get paid by direct deposit, which is the majority of U.S. workers, it is extremely simple to divert your pay into more than one account. Caleb Newquist, the head of content for payroll manager Gusto, which serves 60,000 small businesses across the United States, diverts his own pay into three accounts: spending, saving, and investing. Quote, I was trying to trick myself into saving money into an account I don't use very often. At Gusto, just 7% of employees split their pay into more than one account, with a few splitting their pay into 9 bank accounts. Oh, my goodness. At ADP, which is the largest payroll processor in the United States, serving more than 30 million Americans, the number who split is 15%, with the majority splitting into just 2 accounts. And by the way, most employers, it says, do not highlight the option to split, but there are some initiatives like Split to Save from the nonprofit Consumer Federation of America that do encourage employees to build emergency funds. So that's a way to basically build some emergency savings. And then the piece goes on to talk about the key steps for making your own tax refund. Number one, do your taxes. And I, just to be clear, this is basically figuring it out yourself. So Beth Pinsker's piece goes on to say, Online calculators are no substitute at the moment for just doing your actual tax return. In other words, don't guesstimate using those things to actually do it. The baseline for 2019 is not your refund, but your total tax due. And this is so specific. I love this piece. She literally says, this year, that is line 15. If your income and other tax situations are going to change, like you plan to get married or buy a house, you have to factor those into your math. You also can use IRS's W-4 withholding calculator, and there's a link in the article, but it is currently like a mini tax return anyway, and it might be changing by the summer, Peter Eisberg of ADP points out. And then just quickly, the rest, update your withholding, because that, of course, I think is the key problem for many Americans, that they weren't taking out the right amount given the tax changes. And then, of course, save the rest, because you're already in the payroll system. Make a direct deposit and put more money into savings. And then ideally one that has an online bank with a high interest rate. And then you're basically making your own refund. You're basically doing some forced savings that you can give yourself. So thoughts, Joe?
Well, I love this idea, don't you? Because
it's very empowering.
Absolutely empowering. I had a local TV station here, which was awesome, yesterday, recording a couple
Joe's
segments.
Very famous.
I don't know if you know, I'm incredible. But we talked about this same issue of fewer people getting refunds, and they wanted me to explain how we're getting more money. You know, we're paying less in taxes. The vast majority of people in the United States are paying less tax. But at the same time, we're getting smaller refunds. Like, how does that work? And so I got to explain that. But the cameraman said, when I was trying to explain that you don't want a refund, he said, after we started wrapping up, he goes, you know what, Joe, I see your point, but I respectfully disagree. I have a hard time saving myself. So I like having the forced saving of getting the refund so that I've got this ball of money in my hand. And I said, do you really want to delegate your forced saving to the government? I mean, you can create a forced saving system yourself, like it says here in the piece, by having money automatically leave, go to a savings account that's a little bit out of sight, out of mind, and make it so that it's not that easy to get to. You can do that yourself. Or do you want to delegate it?
I'm sorry. Finish your point, Joe. Sorry.
Well, I just said, or do you want to delegate it to the government?
The other way to look at it is, do you want to loan someone money interest-free? So therefore, you're basically losing money. Or do you want to be earning money on this forced saving? So if you are getting a refund, you are effectively loaning the government money for free. If you somehow divert that amount into a high interest savings account, first of all, you have it if your calculations are off, number one. So it's there as a backup. So if for some reason the numbers are off, something changes in your circumstances, you've saved that extra money. But more importantly, you're earning money on that savings instead of giving it to the government as an interest-free loan. And that's, if you phrase it that way, maybe that would have helped the cameraman.
Well, it's funny. The cameraman and I actually talked about that, Bobby, because he said, you know, I'm earning at my bank very little savings. So if I look at the tiny interest rate, it's not like I'm actually making money. And I said, the rates that we've had lately are not indicative of usual rates. Like, most of the time I was a practicing financial planner, rates were between 4% and 6%. So it was, you know, in a lot of cases, double or, well, what's the FDIC just came out and said that the average high interest savings account now is at 0.6%. You go to a place like a Magnify Money and you'll have maybe 2.3 to 2.5%. With online banks. So we are looking at half of what we used to earn. So these are not normal times. If we go back to normal times, which it seems like we're headed that way, your point to actually earning money on your savings, I think, is pretty compelling.
And first of all, it also goes to, if you see a dollar on the floor, would you pick it up? Yeah, you would. I mean, at the end of the day, money is money, and you're just talking about the amount. So what's the breaking point where it matters to you? I think that's a question of just respecting money. And if you respect money, then you should pay attention to the fact that you can earn more money by not necessarily the ideal is to come in on target with your taxes and not be owed anything and not owe the government anything. So in a perfect world, we're going to estimate exactly on target. I personally think getting, you know, the smallest amount in either direction is ideal. And if you're worried about it, then instead of overpaying your taxes so much, overpay your savings accounts. And then you have the money right there, totally accessible. If you do owe the government money, you're never going to be a pinch. And you can give yourself the same year-end bonus as the author, yeah. Beth Pinsker, points out, basically, at the end of the year, or the end of the tax year, however you want to delegate it. Or maybe you just keep it there, and that becomes something that you can roll some into maybe investments that are going to pay more than that minimal checking account, because it will add up over time.
Right.
Like everything.
It becomes like this airport where you can use it to fund all your different goals, all your different stuff. I'm going to disagree here with Dylan. We do a this podcast in front of a live Facebook audience. If you want to join us, head to facebook.com/iStackBenjamins. And we're here three times a week doing these shows. But Dylan says many don't have the willpower. If they know there's another account, they may raid it. Remember, most can't afford a $400 emergency. So there's no interest built for those without willpower if they'll raid the account. Here's where I disagree with what Dylan said. By the way, I totally agree, Dylan, with all of that. But I think if we know ourselves, we have to build that into the plan. What I love is this idea of starting with you and then working backwards. So if I don't have a lot of willpower, like most people don't, and I don't have money for an emergency, but I want to do better than delegating it to the government, what do? I create a savings account that's hard to reach. And I don't make it hard to reach because I want to pay a bunch of fees to get at my money. I make it hard to reach so that I fight against my lack of willpower. So I used to, when I was a financial planner, I practiced in Detroit. We would set up a savings account in Minneapolis. And then if somebody had an emergency and you needed the money right away, you could pay a fee to have the money wired to you. And it was funny because it was like, what? It was, I think it was a $12 fee. If you had a $12 fee between you and your money, what was amazing was, if it's a true emergency, who cares about 12 bucks? But this little $12 fee would make your brain go, well, I don't want to pay 12 bucks, so maybe there's a different way to handle this. And people would always tell me, they'd say it was amazing. I would always come up with a different way. Otherwise, if it was an emergency and we were saving for like a down payment for some, you know, like a cruise we're taking for the first, you know, the first thing for a vacation, or we're taking our vacation, or we're paying for a car, whatever it is, we got a couple days for that. So then the money would easily be in your account in 24 hours. So if it's not a huge emergency, you had this 24-hour buffer. And it was amazing how setting up these little checks and balances against your willpower made it easier for you to actually save money and not have to just hand it to the government, which I think is like the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I see Lori is making a comment that it's hard to estimate your taxes, especially when she tries to use a tax calculator, it doesn't show her the actual amount. Well, Beth Pinsker points out in this article, at this point, you could just do your taxes. That was her suggestion, just go online and just do them, and then maybe use that as a guideline going forward, because we don't think there'll be any major tax changes between the 2018 returns we're doing now and the 2019. So do the actual numbers, just run the numbers yourself.
The problem this year, Laura, too, is that a lot of the tax calculators are having a difficult time because this is a year where we've had a tax law change. And I love the part, Bobby, that you read about how a lot of the withholding things are probably going to change. And that's because of so many people complaining that they're not getting refunds. The IRS is probably going to jack up your withholding a little bit so that more people get refunds again.
Psychology, you know, at the end of the day. So, and that's fine if it makes people happy. And you can always, you know, usually your employer will automate some of that, but you can always override it if you are one of the people that does feel comfortable either trying to pay on target or maybe owe the government just a little bit so that you don't have that interest-free loan that we've been talking about. You can go in and change your paperwork to whatever you want, but they probably will adjust the automated ones.
Yeah, we're looking
at... We also don't have exemptions anymore. I think that messed people up.
I think that messed a lot of people
up. That's the biggest thing, because that was the kind of thing that people could really play with.
I've had people talk to me just in the past few weeks about, do you want a receipt for that, for this charitable donation? And I said, well,
no.
I can't really deduct that anymore. So no, I'm just happy to give.
Yeah.
David talking about...
I mean, the standard deductions have really gone up. So yeah, a lot of people are not itemizing.
Yeah, can't itemize that. Your mortgage. David talking about a high interest rate at a bank where he's at. Hey, David. David coming out with a great book on student loans, by the way.
Yes.
Nice job, David. Congratulations.
I'm looking forward to that. And David, I think I'm certainly looking forward to having him on the Financial Grown-Up podcast.
He'll be on Stacking Benjamins too, talking about that. Absolutely. Jennifer says her savings accounts are at different banks and it takes 2 to 3 days for money to transfer. I love the 2 to 3 day thing.
That's good.
Just because it's this little buffer between you and your willpower. I love it. And see if we got anything else. Mike, if that's for me, by the way, take a message.
Yeah, there's nothing I can do about that phone. That is my landline that my husband refuses to get rid of.
This is why
it's only telemarketers and I can't even turn it off. I've tried and he gets very mad. I hide it in drawers and then he gets mad at me for taking it out. So
I'm glad, darling. I'm glad it's you
now
today.
Now everyone's hearing our phone.
Instead of me, because I think the last 7 times it's been me with the live recording session. Mike's talking about a blog post here. Mike, you can have the blog post. 5 best savings accounts for high income earners that spend what they earn. There you go. We just gave Mike a blog post idea. If that scores, Mike, we'll accept our commission in a high yield savings account if you want to set one up for us. Thank you very much. I think that's probably good transition time, Bobby.
Yeah, let's go to our second headline, which is by Ted Godbout. It is, why do more than a third of workers retire earlier than planned? I don't know what the source is now, Joe.
NAPA-NET, the National Association of Plan Advisors. Those are the people that manage pension funds and 401ks, that sort of thing.
Cool. And as anyone can tell, Joe selected this headline. All right, here we go. The impact of life's unexpected changes clearly plays a large role in early retirement, but there also appear to be other dynamics at work, according to a new white paper. In, quote, retiring earlier than planned, what matters most, authors Alicia Munell, Matthew Rutledge, and Jeffrey, big challenge here, Sanzenbacher, of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, set out to determine the impact of unexpected changes in health, employment, family, and finances on early retirement and the prevalence of these shocks. Citing data from EBRI, the researchers note that the share of workers reporting that they expect to work past age 65 rose from 16% in 1991 to 48% in 2018. So a lot more people expect to retire. I mean, to keep working past age 65.
Yeah.
Yet, here's where it goes funky. Yet, such intentions often go awry, as findings from the University of Michigan's Health and Retirement Study indicate that 37% of workers retire earlier than planned. The question now becomes, Joe, why? Why, Joe? Why? All right. So to determine it, they first defined and quantified earlier than planned retirements, determined potential types of shocks, identified which shocks mattered most, taking into account both their potency and prevalence. All right, overall, this is what's important here. Health shocks were found to be the most important factor in earlier than planned retirements. The paper explains that individuals face 2 kinds of health shocks. The first occurs when existing health conditions affect one's ability to work more than anticipated. The second occurs when someone's health changes between the age at which they plan and their planned retirement age. The regression results indicate that several shocks have a statistically significant effect on retiring early. For example, those with an existing health condition at the time they report a planned retirement age, there's only a 3.3% increase in the probability of retiring early, as people seem to be surprised by how fast their ability to work deteriorates. In other words, they kind of know that they're not feeling well, there's something wrong, but they don't really think it's going to have as big an impact. If everyone made their plans in perfect health and had no changes in their health, the overall share of early retirements would drop by 4.8 percentage points from 37 to 32. Following health shocks were involuntary job losses and changes with the family. The effect of a job loss is very dependent on the worker's ability to find a new job. So that goes to what I just said, the involuntary job loss.
Yeah.
If a worker finds one, they are 6.6 percentage points less likely to retire early. But if they do not find that new job, Joe, they are 27 percentage points more likely to retire early.
Wow.
On the other hand, switching jobs voluntarily is related to a 6.8% decrease in the probability, blah, blah, blah. Basically, it comes down mostly to health, Joe. And then the other reasons are involuntary job loss, meaning you become unemployed. You don't want to be unemployed, but it is imposed on you. And then, of course, changes with the family, which often goes to people that are in their 50s and 60s. They're not quite ready to retire, but they might have to take care of an aging parent or maybe a child that needs help as well.
Think about how many of these are beyond your control. You know, the real reason you retire being beyond your control. And it's funny because when I was a financial planner, people always acted like they were in control of everything. And it's funny that especially when it comes to disability, we never wanted to admit. So many people I met with, this was the hardest thing. So we talk about cash flow, cash reserve, debt management, all this, come up with a strategy. People were awesome. They always want to talk about that. Then the second part of a financial plan is this protection planning idea. What if bad things happen? And so many people, you could see their body language. They would go from leaning forward to leaning back with their arms crossed. They would look at the floor. They wouldn't want to talk about it. And especially, it's funny, they would talk about if I die. Because it's not if, it's really when. And everybody knows that.
That's so morbid, though, when you say it that way, Joe.
Right. But it is. So because of that, people were fine talking about that. But disability really is an if. We don't know if it's going to happen to us. And and that's why people never wanted to talk about it, because I'm a safe skier, or I'm a safe driver, or whatever it might be. It was this idea that I can control the future. And it's so sad when you see people that would have a disability and they'd hope they bounce back and they wouldn't. It was so frustrating. It was so absolutely frustrating.
It is. And I think there's so many ways that it hits you. First of all, obviously, it affects your whole life. And to some degree, the only part of that that you can protect yourself from is really the financial hit that comes along with it. Not only the cost of recovering, hopefully I'm going to be more positive than Morbid Joe here today, but the cost of recovering obviously is a factor, but also the cost of not simply being at work. I remember interviewing Sharon Epperson from CNBC. I don't know if you if you know her, if you've interviewed her, but she had an aneurysm while she was in an exercise class. I forget the specifics, but basically one day she just wasn't back at work, and it was a many months recovery. And so it's not just the cost of the recovery, the medical costs, it's also all that lost income that she wasn't contributing to herself and to her family during that time. So that's why things like disability insurance can at least cover that part of your life. That wasn't helping her medically, obviously, but it did alleviate that pressure from her and from her family.
Let's talk a little bit about what you do about this, because there were a couple of problems I saw people face, once again, when I was a financial planner, and I still see statistics on today. When it comes to disability insurance, people think it's a yes, no checkbox. I have it or I don't. And what's sad is that a lot of people that have it at work don't have nearly enough. Often there are two options at work. There's a bigger option, a smaller option. Somebody will check the smaller options just to feel like I checked the yes box that I have some.
But that's at least better than nothing.
It is better than nothing. But we would often do the calculations when I was an advisor, because just like life insurance, it's not about having life insurance, it's about how much you have. And we'd often ask those people to go back to work and buy more, or sometimes a supplemental policy that they needed. So actually doing the math on how much you have when it comes to disability coverage is big. And then the second thing that people don't want to take seriously, and it's mostly, I think, because there's not an easy answer, is this idea of long-term care, which is this big, giant hole in everybody's plan. And man, there's so much money people spend on long-term care. And I like some of the memes that I see. There's been one that's been floating around lately about I'm going to spend my, have you seen this? I'm going to go to a Holiday Inn instead.
I need, I know what you mean. Yes, because it is so expensive to be in these care centers. And I don't think that people are going to do that, but I do think we are re-examining. And when you look at the way that a lot of these plans reimburse people, they do encourage people to be at home with an appropriate professional caregiver. That is often less money for you or for your insurance company than being in a full facility, believe it or not. So I think that we have to have the long-term care insurance. And I tend to be a nerd about that. That is something that I got at a young age. But I also think that we should be watching our health system, because I think there's a lot of discussion about how we're going to care for the aging baby boomer generation and evolving that to a system that is supportive, inclusive, and understanding of the fact that a lot of people, whether they should or not, are not going to have the long-term healthcare. I'm getting a little woo-woo here, but I do think we as a society need to figure that out, because not everyone does have long-term care insurance, which is something very different, often offered by employers. So if you're self-employed, that's tougher to get, more expensive to get. And even if you get it through your insurers, through your company, it is expensive, and they do have the ability to raise the prices in some circumstances. There's parameters, but it's tough. It's tough for a lot of people.
Well, and it's funny you say, you know, you talk about how expensive it is. It's so expensive, that's why people don't want to talk about it. And yet, if you turn this around, and I learned this first from a great book about money called The Truth About Money by Rick Edelman, just probably my favorite personal finance book. Rick says that insurances are priced higher based on whether it's going to happen to you or not. So long-term care policies are not super expensive because they're a ripoff. They're super expensive because they think it's going to happen to you. And that's so he says, generally, we should gravitate toward the types of insurances that cost a lot, and not by buying the insurance, but by having a strategy in those areas. So in other words, if long-term care is a super expensive insurance, that means we should come up with a strategy to handle long-term care. May or may not include insurance, but we should have a strategy. Something like, you know, hurricane coverage, if I live in Kansas, it might not be that important, but it costs pennies on the dollar, Joe. It's cheap. This stuff is cheap. Well, it's cheap because it's not going to happen.
That's like umbrella insurance, which I am also a fan of, is buying umbrella insurance, especially if you have a large family and you've accumulated assets, just in case. And that is cheap because the odds are against you probably ever using that, because you're probably going to only use it if you exhaust all your other insurance that's relevant to whatever happens. But, you know, it's cheap, and I don't think it's a bad idea to have that either.
No, it's fantastic to have. You think about all the times that something could go wrong, and umbrella, just a very simple way to cover all those what-ifs. Nice stuff. We got some great people commenting here. Dylan says, the ones who have higher chance of needing disability insurance often forego it because it's more expensive for them. So true. And the bad news is when it's more expensive, as we just talked about, that's when you probably need it. Elizabeth is a big fan. Says, great topic and input, Bobby. Nice job.
Thank you.
Gregory says,
did we get to Sandy? Oh, sorry.
Let's go to Sandy. Is it this one? That's why long-term care coverage and long-term disability are two coverages that people overlook and really need as they get older.
Yes. And her other comment, which was, if you've ever had to care for an aging parent, you realize the value in those coverages. And she talks about that she couldn't convince her husband to look at those policies. He thinks she's overinsured. But having to care for his mom for the better part of a decade has changed his mind. He now understands the financial burden. So it's not, I love this point that Sandy's making, because it's not really about you. It's about the people that would be filling that financial gap if you don't have it. And that could very well be your children. And that's not something you want to impose on them. So this is not really, I mean, it is protection for you and your finances. It's also protection for your entire, I call it a family ecosystem that you want to be protecting.
This is such an emotional topic. And a lot of people are like Sandy's husband, where they look at the price tag and go, yeah, no, we don't need that much insurance. Like, you know, our natural thing is to go with less, which is why I think it's important, Bobby, to start with the statistical probability that something will happen. Start with the statistics and then say, okay, as a, you know, if I'm playing the statistics like an actuary would, which of these do I need to insure and which of these don't I need to insure? And when you look at the statistics, insuring against a disability is a huge thing. Your homeowners, by the way, which is really inexpensive. Well, you think about this. Let's just go do this simple thing. Your homeowners insurance versus your car insurance. For most people, which one's most expensive? Your car insurance, usually for most of us, is more expensive than our homeowners insurance. Yet, okay. Absolutely. When we look at the statistical, if we look at which one costs more, your home hopefully cost a hell of a lot more than your car. If your house costs less than your car, no judgment. Let's just put that, no judgment. But that's not most people. The reason why your car insurance costs more than homeowners costs is because the statistical probability is you're going to have an accident in your car. statistically, there's a very, very slight chance that something's going to happen where you have a homeowner's claim when compared to a car insurance claim. So
I would agree with that.
Good stuff there. I think we're good. Nice job.
Yeah.
Nice job, Facebook team, for rounding that out.
Very substantial commentary from our Facebook audience.
It's such a tough area, so I'm so happy that you guys came through talking about that today. Now everybody gets a gold star.
All right, so we are going to get to the big idea in just a moment if anyone wants to take any guesses. But before that, we were just talking about being organized with buying the different things that you need to buy to make sure that you have the strong financial foundation both for you and for your entire family. And as we talked about earlier in the show, one way to do that is through systems like the one that Tiller has, where it organizes all of your finances on spreadsheets, on Excel, and you can use that to really get a clear picture of what is going on in your financial life. And then you can make the right decisions, and maybe you can figure out a way to organize your finances in a way that you can afford the insurance that you do need and that will protect you, your family, and all of the things that you care about. And it's okay to care about your possessions and whatever. That's all good stuff. Protect your home, protect your house, your car, but find the money by being organized with your finances. And Tiller is a great resource to do that.
Absolutely. Head to stackybenjamins.com/Tiller, T-I-L-L-E-R, and you will get a couple months free to kick the tires on the Tiller stuff. I absolutely love those spreadsheets because I can make them as easy as I want them. And I like it easy, Bobby. The easier.
Easy is always good. Keep it simple. Just like we were talking about with the tax stuff, just set up a simple second account and, you know, float that money over, give yourself your own tax return, make it simple and easy, and you can get it all organized on Tiller.
The only person guessing is, and I don't know if I'm going to find it because, man, we've had a lot of great comments today. Was Dylan earlier on said his big idea is Joe's forced to retire early and wishes he had a bigger refund because Bobby's laying him off from the podcast.
That would never happen.
Thank
you, Dylan.
Awesome. Awesome one.
I think Joe is the Energizer Bunny of podcasts. I don't know how many, I don't think we can even count how many podcast episodes you do a month. You do 12 Stacking Benjamins, 12 Money in the Mornings. You're on, what is the FinCon podcast?
And that's it.
Is
four times a month. Yeah.
That's four times a month. And then you also appear regularly on Paula Pants.
On Afford Anything.
Afford Anything. Am I forgetting anything?
So that's
twice a month or once a month?
Usually twice a month, yeah.
So that's six. So that is, you do 30 podcasts a month.
We spend a lot of time with headphones on. But this is my favorite time, Bobby.
Oh, thank
easily
you,
my favorite.
Mine too. All right. What's the big idea, Joe?
The big idea when it comes to this, I mean, we did get morbid. Somebody was asking.
Oh, wait. Mike has one. Mike has one more guess before we reveal.
And I already revealed it.
Sorry.
But that's all right. Big idea says taxes and death are certain. So get smart with taxes and have insurance. That's good. It wasn't quite what we were going with Mike, but that's an awesome
thank
one.
Thank you, Mike.
You know, my big idea takeaway from this, Bobby, and tell me if you agree, is that even though we were morbid, as Sandy is saying in the comments, are we morbid? Yes, we were morbid. But even though we're morbid,
protective.
This is something we can take control of. We can actually look at the statistics and we can make good decisions to protect ourselves. We can't protect everything, but we can look at statistical probability and we can put a plan in place. And that's pretty powerful. And by the way, when it comes to creating our own refund, we can create an account that's hard to get to that goes against our inability to control ourselves, right? We can play against our lack of willpower and set ourselves up for success. The great thing, and I think this is a cool, great idea, is that you create your future and you get to decide every day how much of it you create or how little you create. And it's funny because often when I have problems in my life, it's because I failed to plan. But that was
I would agree with. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
But that was in my wheelhouse. That was all I was going to say.
Yeah. So, and I agree with everything that Joe has said. I think just think of this as DIY. You need to do it yourself and own your own financial decisions, but use systems to put those things in place. Automate those savings, go to your employer. If they give you pushback about splitting accounts, ask again. Most of them can really do it. And, you know, protect yourself and be your own best advocate.
Great episode, Bobby. Everybody go forth and stack some Benjamins.
And if you guys want to live a rich life, don't forget, you got to be financial grown-ups. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
This show is created by Joe Saul-Sehy, hosted and produced by Bobby Rebell and Joe Saul-Sehy, is engineered by Caden Thompson, and all put together by a pack of well-trained ferrets down here in Joe's mom's basement. You'll find Bobby at the Financial Grown-Up Podcast and Joe at the Stacking Benjamin Show. Go say hi to them there, too. Online, visit us on Twitter at Average Joe Money and at Bobby Rebell, or come join a live recording at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/iStackBenjamins. I know you already know this too, but Money in the Morning is for entertainment purposes only. You should not act on anything recommended by a bunch of entertainers in a basement or even a Manhattan kitchen without first consulting your financial advisor and second, dude, have your head examined. Have headlines you'd like us to discuss? Send them to joe@stackingbenjamins.com or put them on our Stacking Benjamins closed Facebook group. This show is a collaboration of Stacking Benjamins LLC and BRK Media LLC. Copyright 2019. All rights reserved. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and I reserve the right to always say, we'll see you next time back here on Money in the Morning.